I'm going to start a few steps back and review a few things from last time. And one of the important formulae that I wrote down was that if you take the generators of the spinner representation of the Lorentz group and compute the commutator with the gamma matrix matrices, you get this somewhat mysterious looking formula. Something like this, yeah. So this is nothing but an infinitesimal version of the following formula. So you have some some matrices which are representation of the Lorentz transformation, but on spinner space, acting on the gamma matrices via similarity transformation. And this results in that the gamma matrices being rotated by a Lorentz transformation. Okay, so this guy, if you now expand this for small values of the parameter, Lorentz transformation parameter, remember this was defined as minus one, I over 2 omega mu nu sigma mu nu, and the definition of the Lorentz transformation is similarly where I gave you explicit expressions for the set of matrices, 4 by 4, the matrices M. Now, if you expand those, then and plug those in this formula and keep the linear order terms linear order in omegas, the parameters, you just get this, okay? Then by the end of the lecture, we discussed, I gave you a list of objects. That I claimed had well-defined Lorentz transformation properties and some well-defined properties under parity. So I motivated that under parity, you know, a Dirac spinner should transform like this. Okay, sorry, let me be more specific. Space X time, then and then we saw that under parity, this object transforms like a scalar, that we called it a scalar. Whereas we call this thing a pseudoscalar. However, I did not explicitly work out why, for example, this object should be considered a vector. So by vector, what we usually understand is something which transforms like a vector under boost and rotation, right? But now if we use that second formula over there, then we see that this is a vector, because under a Lorentz transformation, psi goes to S of psi, gamma mu does not change, then psi bar goes like S inverse. So this is So thus we see that this object does transform like a vector. I may have gotten the position of some of the indices wrong, but similarly, if you consider this expression with the gamma 5 inserted, under the normal Lorentz transformation, that is boosts and rotation, they transform, this guy transforms exactly like this object. So under rotation and boost, this thing also looks like a vector. But under parity, its behavior is different from the behavior here. Under parity, what happens is that, so let's call this a V0, V mu. Under parity, V0 goes to V0, but the 3 component goes to minus this, right? And we can just prove that by using this relationship. Okay. And let's call this guy A of mu. Then under parity, the zeroth component behaves like this, whereas the 3 components do not change. So this is what we call a pseudovector. Okay? So these are the things I wanted to review from last time. But also I wanted to just mention that when I derive the dimensionality of the representation of the Dirac spinner, I defined something called vacuum to be a state, to be a vector that is annihilated by all the Loring operators that I created from linear combination of the gamma matrices, right? So this is a group theoretic construction. This is not the vacuum in the sense of the physical vacuum, okay? So this is a little bit like, you know, if you have, say, two angular momentum, two spin half particles, and you take their tensor product, then you get a spin one particle and a spin zero particle, right? And if I look at the spin zero particle, if I look at the z component of its spin, then the z component of the spin has either a spin zero or spin minus one or plus one, right? Now we can use the j plus operator to go in this direction, but once we have reached this state, if I apply j plus again, I get zero. And we go to this direction by the j minus operator, but once we have reached this state, when we apply j minus, we go to zero. So in a sense, this is a vacuum, and this is a vacuum. So that's what I called it vacuum. But it's I should not have used that language, okay? I take it back. What I mean is that it's a maximally stressed state. It's a state which is annihilated by all the Loring operator. Okay. All right, so that kind of finishes my review of last lecture. So far I've kind of given you some overview of the mathematical properties of spinners, some of their group theoretic properties. So today, our topic is Lagrangians. For spinners. So Lagrangians are where the action is, right? Ha. See, I can also make puns. Okay, so now you see, we kind of looked at all the nice, all the bilinear of spinors, which transform nicely under the Lorentz transformation. But we know that for physics, we need derivatives in our Lagrangian, right? Without derivatives, there are no physics. You know, we need calculus. So a derivative operator, this transform as a covariant vector. Okay, so this should transform as a kind of a scalar, but of course, it'll only transform as a scalar if I sandwich it between two Dirac spinors. So that should be a scalar, right? Because this guy transforms as a covariant vector. So I think it's a covariant vector. Whereas the other guys, as we saw there, they transform as a contravariant vector, so the combination is a scalar, is a Lorentz scalar. And then we multiplied by an I, because I will argue that putting an I there makes the Lagrangian real, makes the action real under integration by parts. Okay? So this is basically, you know, a good kinetic term. So you might say, okay, why did not we say do something like this as our kinetic term? Right? So it has, you can show that, you know, kinetic terms like that do not lead to positive energies if psi is a spinner. Apart from that, if we had a kinetic term like this, this would not force psi to be a spinner. It would only force psi to be a complex scalar, right? So we need to write a kinetic term which forces psi to be a spinner, which is something that is done admirably by this guy, right? Like, this thing will not be Lorentz invariant if psi is not a spinner. Whereas this term doesn't care if psi is a spinner or not. So that's why we need to enforce the spinner nature of psi by writing something like this.
Yes?
Right. Yes. So actually, we'll get the kinetic term, one of the terms in the Dirac equation from this Lagrangian. So before, so this is not good. So before we, you know, go and add terms to this, you know, just let's do a little bit of dimensional analysis. So action in our case would be given something like this, right? So in the units that we are using, which are units where h bar is equal to c is equal to 1, the action doesn't have any dimensions. It's dimensionless. But the mass dimension of the measure of the action is, what is it? -4, yes. So what is the dimension of this guy? +1, right. So then what should be the dimension, mass dimension of the spinners? Complex conjugation should not really change the dimension, right? Yeah, gammas are just numbers, yes. They're dimensionless. Three halves, right? Yeah. Okay. So that's the dimensionality of the spinners. So given this, now let us write a mass term. So the mass term should be invariant. So let's take a leaf out of our Klein-Gordon Lagrangian and write the mass term like this. So this, what is the dimensionality of this constant now? Mass. So whereas in the Klein-Gordon case, the dimensionality of the what's the dimensionality of the Klein-Gordon field? Scalar field. Yeah, in four dimensions. One. So there we had an m squared, but here we only need to. We have something the constant has the same dimension as mass, so we write it as m. Okay. So this way we arrive at the famous Dirac Lagrangian. Where this is the famous Feynman slash notation. So the fact that, you know, this term is real, manifestly real. This term, I'll leave it as an exercise for you to show that is real under integration by parts, okay? All right, any questions so far? Good, I like a quiet class. So let's derive the equations of motion using the Euler-Lagrange equation. So let's write, what is the Euler-Lagrange equation say for the psi bars? And now I'm writing the spinner index explicitly. So there's this term, and then we can always divide this term into two parts, like half and half, and just integrate one of the parts and rewrite the Dirac Lagrangian in a way where you have one term which is acting on the derivative of psi, another term which is acting on the derivative of psi bar. We can always do that, but we won't. So, this gives us the famous Dirac equation. Okay. Because the Dirac equation is relativistic, and because it's a wave equation, it has to solve the Klein-Gordon equation. Because the Klein-Gordon equation is, classically speaking, is nothing but a statement about the relativistic invariance of waves propagating. So if you want to see this, you apply this operator to the Dirac equation. So, and do a little bit of algebra. So the first term becomes gamma mu, gamma nu, mu of nu the cross terms cancel out. Now, because mu, the partial derivatives are symmetric, I can rewrite this term in terms of an anti-commutator for gammas, and then use the Dirac algebra, and then this term becomes the D'Alembertian . So the Dirac equation satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. Sorry, the Dirac spinner satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. Historically, this is how Dirac discovered the gamma, the Dirac algebra. He wrote down an equation which was first order in time, because he was looking for a first order, first derivative in time equation, because he wanted to mimic the positive probability density of Schrodinger's equation. But relativity told him that then his spatial derivatives also needs to be first order. So he wrote something down, and he contracted the derivatives with some objects. He called them alphas and betas, alpha and betas. We are calling them gammas. He didn't know what those objects, what properties they had to satisfy. And then he said, well, I'm going to impose the fact that any solution to my equation must also be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So, and he found that if that was going to be true, that will be true only if those gamma objects, they satisfy the Dirac algebra. That's how Dirac discovered the Dirac algebra. And after that, you know, there's this clever argument that you go to a different reference frame and you want the same equation to be the to be valid, then that relationship for the gamma matrices follow from that. That's the historical route, but we are not going down that route. Okay, so now what we are going to do is that we are going to just rewrite the Dirac Lagrangian in the chiral basis or the vowel basis. Okay. So before I do that, let me just step. Yes.
Before you move on. Yeah. So if I recall correctly, when you did that, he found the matrices had to be at least four-dimensional.
Right.
They could be higher.
They could be higher, but I don't think you'd have. They'd be for massive case, they would still be reducible. But if M is non-zero, the lowest dimensionality that you could have is 4 by 4. But if you go higher, I think you could still satisfy that. But then that representation for the massive case would actually not be irreducible. So okay. I think it'll become a little bit more clear what I'm going to say when we look at this, the Dirac Lagrangian in the vowel representation. Okay, so the vowel representation. Before I do that, let's revisit the vowel representation. In the vowel representation, a Dirac spinner has a left-handed part and a right-handed part. Okay. So now, if I write in the vowel representation the spinorial representation of the Lorentz group elements, they are block diagonal, so there is some left component. And there's some right component. Right. And recall that the bar is this object. And do you remember what gamma zero is? Anyone? Okay, yeah, Morten, you've been chosen.
0110.
Good. So that means that this is going to be phi r dagger chi l dagger, right? Okay. So this is an important point. So now, under a Lorentz transformation, the Dirac spinner goes something like this. It transforms like this. But what it means is that the left component transforms like this. But its Hermitian conjugate transforms in the in that way, okay? Let me just raise this. Right, you just like plug this expression in here and in the bars, right?
Have you got your chi's and phi's
right? Okay, sorry, yeah. This should be a chi, right? Yeah, chi. And, okay. I'm sorry. Chi L, chi L, and then chi, sorry, okay. Chi L, okay. Great. So what it's saying is that the left-handed wow spinner transforms in the left-handed representation, but the Hermitian conjugate transforms in some sense in the right-handed representation. So, right. And if I now plug in this expression into our favorite expression up there, then we get the result that SL inverse acting on sigma mu SR is gamma mu of nu sigma nu, and SR inverse acting on sigma bar of mu SL sigma bar. I'm just like translating the properties of the four-dimensional gamma matrices to the 2x2 sigma matrices. So now let's rewrite the kinetic term for the Dirac Lagrangian in terms of the left-handed and the right-handed fields. Then we have, so I'm going to drop the D from now on. So this is I. Phi r dagger, comma and this is So let's pause for a second and look at and stare at this formula or at this expression. And I want to claim that each of these terms is invariant under the Lorentz transformation as we have written it out in two-component notation, right? That should be obvious from those formula. Like, we know how sigma mu and sigma mu bar transform. We know how chi L and chi L dagger transform. And we know how the deltas transform, right? The derivatives transform. So now I can write a kinetic term for what I will call a vial spinner. A left-handed vial spinner to be this. So this is a perfectly okay Lorentz invariant Lagrangian for a two-component vial spinner. Yes?
Could you repeat how we knew that S of lambda broke up into that?
Right. Yeah. So the way it happened is that we wrote that.
Was it because the S commuted with gamma 5 or something?
Sorry?
Was it because the S commuted with gamma 5?
Yes.
Because S commuted with gamma 5 in the basis, in the representation in which gamma 5 is diagonal, S then has to be diagonal. And when the sigmas. And when we exponentiate the sigmas, you know, they would respect that block diagonal form. Yes, we did. When we did this, remember psi L went like, for the infinitesimal case, we did 1 plus, I forget if there was a plus or minus here, beta dot sigma minus I theta dot sigma by 2 psi L, right? So this is the infinitesimal version of this guy. Okay. So similarly, we can write down a Lagrangian for the right-handed component, and they do not need to come from a master Lagrangian, right? So that this Lagrangian by itself is a good theory of a free two-component spinner. It's a vial spinner. Now, on physical ground, we don't expect the spinner to have mass because vial spinners are eigenstates of the helicity operator. Okay, this is something I'm just going to say. If it doesn't make sense, we can talk about this later. But it'll take some while to sink in. we are calling these spinners left-handed and right-handed. That means that this is a frame-independent statement that we are making. That in all reference frames, all boosted, related by each other by boosts, they should all be left-handed. But the helicity of an object flips if it's massive. You can make it flip. The thing is that So suppose a particle with some mass is traveling in some direction, and there is it has a certain spin. Now, if you boost your reference frame, which is moving faster than the object, then although its direction of spin doesn't change, its momentum does. So the helicity flips. But for massless particles, you cannot do that. And therefore, for massless particles, helicity is a good quantum number, right? So let's just see this mathematically that, you know, if you try to add a mass term for the Weyl spinner, it doesn't work. So let's write out our mass term that we figured we added to the Dirac spinner. And now if we now write it out in terms of our two-component left-handed and right-handed objects, right, so this guy by itself, so what we see is that the mass terms mix the different representations, okay? So we could not write a mass term purely in terms of chi's. At least that mass term does not come from this mass term. Now in your homework, there is the second problem is about how to write down spinners, two-component spinners, which do have masses. Such spinners do not have a left-handed or a right-handed interpretation, and those spinners are called Majorana spinners. And so I'm going to turn to the definition of the Majorana spinners next, okay? Before I move on, any question? Sorry?
I thought the Majorana spinners were massless and Dirac spinners.
No, the Weyl spinners are massless. Dirac spinners are massive. Majorana spinners are spinners which are their own antiparticles. So they do not have the charge is not conserved for the simplest Majorana spinners. Oh, it was just a way for me to kind of show you that each of these components of the Dirac spinner give rise to a kinetic term, which is invariant under Lorentz transformation. So this guy does not get mixed up with this guy. Therefore, let me just finish, then I'll. Therefore, we can just use this to write down another Lagrangian just for chi L. But we cannot do that for the mass terms. Okay, so sorry, you also had something else to say.
So the Weyl spinners cannot be massive?
The Weyl spin, so yeah. If we call a Weyl spinner to be the object which follows from a Lagrangian like this, we cannot write down a mass term for them. Therefore, they cannot be massive. I mean, I haven't really given you a proof. All I've said is that the mass term that, you know, if you were to try to mimic the same thing that happened here, but from this mass term, we fail. Okay, therefore, we don't add those mass terms. Yeah?
The way you've written it down, can you think of a Dirac field as like two Weyl fields?
Exactly. So the Dirac field can be thought of as a left-handed Weyl spinner and a right-handed Weyl spinner, and they are related by the Dirac equation, the mass term of the Dirac equation. The mass term of the Dirac equation mixes them up. That's how we can think of it. Okay, so Mr. Majorana vanished, but his spinner didn't. So, So far, you know, we have written down a Dirac spinner in terms of left-handed and right-handed, you know, vowel spinners. And they are completely different objects. They don't have to have any relationship. But what if we relate to them? We can relate to them, right? We can impose a condition which relates the left-handed and the right-handed vowel spinners. So, yeah?
Why do you sometimes write chi L and sometimes psi L?
I'm not committed to any Greek letter, I guess. It's very confusing. I know it's very confusing because sometimes psi, it seems like, is a four-component object, and then when I write psi L, it's a two-component object. And then, I'm very sorry. I mean, it's a bad habit. Yeah, don't. So yeah, it's a contextual. You know, the interpretation of the symbol is contextual, and the symbol means what that the symbol defines that context, right? So it's all circular.
Then you could just stop calling your names like.
Okay, Tom. Tom left. Tom right. Okay. But if you know, Mike's got a point, so I'm just gonna. Since I'm gonna relate them, let's call this left hand spinner chi. Then note that if I write psi of r to be minus I sigma 2 chi star, then that's consistent with the way a Dirac spinner transforms, right? Because in last class, we saw that when the way that psi transformed, sigma 2 of the complex conjugate of that object transformed in the right-handed way, opposite way, right? Sorry, I should repeat that. So psi L transforms in one way, psi R transforms in another way. But psi L star multiplied by sigma 2 transforms in the same way as psi R. So if I identify psi L to be this, psi R up to some constant, which I choose to be minus I for this lecture, it's consistent with the way that Dirac psi d transforms.
Is this a claim that it can be written like that, or it has to be written like
that? Up to a constant, if I am going to identify, make a relationship between psi L and psi R, it has to be like that, up to a constant, which I choose to be minus I here. Okay. So having done that, you can easily check that the complex conjugate of the Dirac spinner is related to the Dirac spinner by this matrix. Where I call this C, or the charge conjugation matrix. Okay? And this C is a unitary, so it looks like an E. Anyway. Right. So I'm kind of, you know, getting a little ahead of myself, because I'm calling this charge conjugation matrix, but I've not told you what charge conjugation is. So that will be the content of next week's first tutorial, is we'll talk about charge conjugation. Yes?
You know? So why are we free to choose the constant? We've shown that sigma 2 psi L star transforms as psi R.
Right.
But how do we know psi R is the multiple of
So the constant that you choose there actually is related to the explicit expression for the C. You know, let me think about that. It's a good question. I actually was trying to figure this out earlier today, but I ran out of time. So let me think about that. Okay. In fact, you know, in the homework, I have a different choice there. So just to make it consistent with Peskin. Okay. So we define for, so this is for any Dirac spinner. So define for any Dirac spinner psi a charge conjugate which we shall call psi c by psi of c is defined to be the charge conjugation matrix acting on the spinner psi. Okay. So having done that, okay, where C has these properties, and so the definition of a Majorana spinner, so this, now I'm going to give you a basis independent definition. So a Majorana spinner is one which satisfies this condition. In other words, a Majorana spinner is its own charge conjugate. Sometimes they're called real spinners because somehow you're saying that. So there is a representation of the gamma matrices in which a Majorana spinner is actually real. Or is it it's real, and the Dirac matrices in that representation are imaginary, pure imaginary.
Okay. It seems like you've got kind of two alternative definitions of C, two different ways you define C here, one of which is like basis dependent, one of which is basis independent.
Right.
Is the C on the left, like this matrix you've written down, is that a special case of the C on the right?
Right.
And in which case
that's it. That is the, in the chiral representation.
The chiral representation. Yeah. Now, is there only one C for, like, is that C well defined by the equations on the right?
Yes, it should be. Yes, it is. Yeah. It's all related by some similarity transformation.
Okay.
In fact, you can show it to be gamma two, right? Or is that a choice?
So
textbooks are mysteriously vague about this point, you know.
So psi c is well defined, and in the Dirac representation, psi c is equal to psi star.
Not the Dirac, the var representation.
Nobody talks about
the Dirac representation.
The var representation.
Very few people do, but there is a gamma matrix representation called the Dirac representation. People usually talk about the var representation because things look. The thing is that when you write down the standard model is not symmetric. It's a parity violating. So when you write down the Lagrangian for the standard model in which all its symmetries manifest, you have to write it down in terms of two component spinners, in terms of vowel spinners. And then, you know, so it's very popular. The vowel representation for that reason is very popular. But,
okay. But sorry, but in the vowel representation, we just happen to have the psi star equals psi c.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, psi star, yes, yes. Right, so the, yes, good. Okay, now the next half an hour of your life is going to be the most tedious half an hour of your life. So please, like, just, you know, call up that deep resolve that you have inside of you. The deep resolve that made you become a physicist. Because I'm going to talk about the classical solutions of Dirac equation. This is just has to be done. Like, there is no other way. But there won't be anything conceptually. Actually, there is a conceptual fun thing. I'll try to point it out. But there's a lot of formula that I'm not going to prove. It's a couple of lines of algebra, really. But OK, so. So classical solutions of the Dirac equation. So the Dirac, the solution to the Dirac spinner solves the Klein-Gordon equation. So we know that such a solution must exist. So P is a four vector. It is the momentum of a part of associated with the momentum. And we know that, you know, these form the complete basis for the positive energy, sorry, the positive frequency modes of the Klein-Gordon classical field, right? So why is it called? So here we say P0 is greater than 0. Why is, what are these guys called positive frequency modes? Historically, these were thought to be positive energy modes. And that's because the energy operator in quantum mechanics is something like this. And when you apply it to this guy, you get a positive energy, right, for P0. And that's why they were called. Now we understand that the negative energy modes are actually, they have positive energy. So now we call them just negative frequency modes, and these are called the positive frequency modes. But the positive frequency mode has a minus sign in terms in front of the P dot X. Yes, John?
Why is negative frequency more satisfying than negative energy?
Because it's, if you write down the Hamiltonian that comes from the quantum, from the quantum field after quantizing it, that that measures the quantum, real quantum energy, right? You know, you know, that actually has a positive definite energy, right?
But negative
frequency
also seems silly
to me. You gotta call it something.
It's moving backwards in time. It's perfectly fine.
Right. Well, let's call this something. They call the other thing nothing.
Okay.
So, of course, this does not guarantee that, you know, this is going to solve the Dirac equation. Okay. So, if we require this psi also solves the Dirac equation, that's going to put some constraints on these four component objects U. So let's put in the spinner index explicitly. The spinner index goes here. In the literature, some people will call these spinners and these spinners interchangeably. Just be warned. So now if you plug this into the Dirac equation in the chiral basis, this is the equation, we get this equation. So let's write our four component spinners as, in terms of two component spinners, U1 of P. So this has two components, and U2 of P. Okay. So when we plug this guy into the Dirac equation, we get so in the limit, where our particle is at rest, that is, we put P mu to be this guy. So let's give this a name, P mu of 0. In that limit, you know, these two, P dot sigma and P dot sigma bar, that they just become M. And we have U1 of P0 becomes equal to U2 of P0. And then we can call them proportional to some two component spinner psi. Now the thing is, and this is a choice of normalization that is going to be convenient for us, and we choose psi to have this normalization. Now because both U1 and U2 are two component objects, psi has two independent components, right? So you can have psi 1 and psi 2. This is a two-dimensional column vector. So starting from this choice of U1 and U2, when the value of the momentum is this, we can now boost this. We can apply a Lorentz boost to the momentum P. So apply a Lorentz boost to the momentum P. And the related boost to the spinner. We know how to work out the spin representation of Lorentz boost. See, doing that, we get U of P for an arbitrary value of P. So you apply some Lorentz boost on this guy. So here we are taking the square root of a matrix. I hope you know how to take the square root of a matrix. So this is something to work out on a Friday evening. Very, very helpful in these sort of manipulations. What's coming is this identity. This is a relativistic generalization of a Pauli matrix identity. Okay. We are almost there. So I hope it is obvious to you that u bar is defined by u dagger of gamma 0. Okay? Oh, did I define u bar? Okay, I'm defining u bar here. Okay. So now we can calculate the inner product between u bar and u. Then you can show that this is given by this. And you know, the way that we chose our normalization for Ksi, that means this is 2 of m. So this is a relativistically invariant normalization. M is a relativistic invariant. So now we can choose, you know, a basis for Ksi, an orthogonal basis. So let's call those Psi 1 and Psi 2. And then we get the relationship, which is orthonormality means this. So when we do this, the u or the u bar, which we get by putting either psi 1 and psi 2, we call that u1 or u2. Now it's a u superscript. Okay. Hang on, I'm going to be a little careful here. Right, okay. Okay, so we can say u of s of p is p dot sigma bar psi of s, okay? And similarly for u bar. Then you can verify these relationships. U bar s of p, u of r of p is 2m delta r of s. However, if I compute this guy, so there is no gamma 0 in between, this thing gives me 2 of EP delta of RS, which is something that is not completely unexpected because the left-hand side is no longer a Lorentz invariant quantity because there's no bar here. The right-hand side is not a Lorentz invariant quantity, right? Okay. So that's all we have to say for now about the positive frequency modes or something modes. Now let's go to the nothing modes. So there should also be solutions to the Dirac equation, which would have the form of e to the power plus I p dot x. So just a reminder, whenever I say p dot x, I mean the four-vector contraction. Okay? So going through the same argument as above, we find solutions of V of the form I'm using eta here, but eta have the same properties as psi. So etas satisfy the same relationship as this. So that there are two etas, eta 1 and eta 2. They correspond to spin up and spin down. Yeah? You're right. See, that was completely intentional. I just wanted to check whether Tom was paying attention. Okay. And similarly, we have relationships such as whenever there's a bar, so this is easy to remember, whenever there's a bar here, and there's P and V of S of P, this should be something Lorentz invariant, and it's minus 2m of delta R of S, and but when there is no bar, just a dagger, it's plus 2 E of P delta of RS. Okay, let's bring that down. So now we have kind of worked out the inner products between the for the U's and the V's. Now we can ask what happens when we take the inner product between U's and V's. That is the inner product between somethings and nothings. Then sometimes you get something, sometimes you get nothing. Right, so U bar of P, this is S, V of R of P is equal to V bar of S of P, U of R of P, and that's zero. But as you may have guessed, this thing is not zero. However, you can verify that if you flip the sign of the spatial momenta of one of the spinners, then that is zero. God knows what this means, but this is extremely useful when you are doing canonical commutation relationships and you have to redefine three momentum P to be minus the three momentum of P. So that's very useful. Similarly,
I'm sorry, when you write that down, you mean like you keep the energy being positive, P0 being positive, and then you just reverse.
Right. Yeah. That you don't P0 is positive in both cases. You don't flip the sign of the energy is the same because whether you flip the sign of the three momentum doesn't change the energy. Okay, so that's one. Similarly, V of S this guy isn't zero, but if I just flip the sign of the three component, then that thing is zero. Okay. All right. We're almost there. So when you calculate physical cross-sections in scattering amplitudes, a lot of times what we do is that we send in unpolarized beams. That means that we are summing over the spinner indices. Well, we don't care if it's psi 1 or psi 2 or u 1 or u 2. Because the interpretation of this index is that it can be spin up or spin down, right? And the V's also spin up and spin down, but the interpreter, you'll see in the next lecture that the U's accompany the U's represent the particle states, the polarizations and the momentums of the particle states. The polarizations of the particle, the spin of the particles, whereas V's represent the spins of the antiparticles. Okay? And in experiments, we send in a lot of times unpolarized states, and our detectors do not distinguish between the polarization. So a lot of times we have to sum over these polarizations. Yeah? Yes, Dan?
You mean sum or average? For the initial?
For the initial, it's average, but for the final, it's sum. You're right, yeah.
When you talk about like the spins being a dimensional space, if we go to like a higher, high-dimensional representation of the Dirac algebra, does that give us high-dimensional spins? Like, can we go to 3 over 2, spin 3 on 2, and so on and so forth? What do we have to do?
Right, so when you go to a higher-dimensional representation of the Dirac algebra, so suppose you take, you can build those up out of products of, say, smaller, representations. And then it'll depend on what representation you're looking at. Some will have spinner index, some will have vector indices. So there will be ways of spinner indices combining to give you a vector index and things like that.
And that would be from the spin
one. Well, there could be spin three halves, for example. You know, there are spin three halves particles and stuff. In nature there are. I mean, they are very short-lived, but there are fundamental theories of spin three halves particles as well. So, yeah.
So if I were to take these IREPs and like smash them together to make a high-dimensional representation, I'd find it would be like two. It would be maybe dimension two to the n, and if n's even, then it's like a. It's a half integer spin. If n is an integer spin, and so that means if n is odd, I can combine the spinner indices to get vector indices. Or is that correct?
Yes. I mean, okay. Right. So the gamma mu, the sigma mu's, these guys will have these have spinner indices, and this has vector indices. So these guys, for example, when you smash it and stuff like this with the appropriate spinners, you actually get a vector, right? Just like that term, right? I mean, the vector that we defined at the beginning of the class, that's just one example of getting a spin one particle from two spin half representations. So there's a whole, well-defined way of deriving those things. So yeah, but you're right. Let me just carry on because I have 11 minutes left, actually 11 minutes plus change. Okay, so what I said was to motivate the next formula, which is if you take the outer product of the spinners, so I'm taking the, so here it's the spinner which is coming first and the conjugate spinner is coming second. And I'm summing over the S. So this is a 4x4 matrix. And this has, in the chiral representation, this has this expression, where similarly, if I sum over the V's, so this is something that's very useful in practical calculations. Okay. So now we are, yes?
Sometimes you're putting four vector p in the argument, sometimes you're putting.
Yeah, it's I'm kind of using them interchangeably. They're all on shell, so I'm assuming that p, the three vector p determines the fourth component, but yeah. Okay. Okay, in the last 10 minutes, I'm just gonna write down a formula for the general solution of the Dirac equation. I'm not gonna dwell on it because we're gonna examine it to its death in the next lecture. But given all of this, we can write down the general solution to the Dirac equation as I'm gonna be lazy and use the fourth blackboard. So, yeah? We haven't really done any quantum field theory yet. We haven't imposed any canonical commutation or anti-commutation relationships. It's quantum mechanical in the old sense, but not quantum field theoretic, right? We quantize. When we say quantize in this course, we are doing a canonical quantization a la quantum field theory. But we are not. The X's are not, say, operators. The position, there is no position operator. The momentum of, there is no derivative the gradients are not momentum operator, for example. So the general solution is then d k 2 pi cubed relativistic normalization sum over the polarizations U of S. I was calling it U of S like this. Let's stick to that, at least for today. I'm gonna confuse Ryan again, and now we have the A's. Actually, A's, I like to use A's for scalar fields, so let's use B's here. So the B of S of P, these are the Fourier coefficients. These are the somethings. And because the Dirac spinner doesn't have to be real, we have a different set of coefficients. Let's call these B stars for now.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. Okay. So that's the general solution, where the A's and the B stars are the Fourier oh God, that should be C. I want to have something different here. Oh God. Okay. Okay, in the remaining 5 minutes, I will just kind of start on something new. A new aspect of the Dirac Lagrangian, which I think is essential, is we are gonna talk about the symmetries of the Dirac theory. Okay. So because I'll have very little time, I will just use the fourth blackboard here. So remember Noether's theorem. Suppose you have some continuous symmetry, continuous transformation of your fields, and which for the infinitesimal case takes this form. And suppose that under such transformation, the Lagrangian changes up to a total derivative, then your action is invariant, provided that the fields kind of go to zero fast enough at infinity. Then Noether's theorem tells you that there exists a current which is conserved, and the current is given by this expression. Where the sum over A is implied. So this is just recapping Noether's theorem. Now let's see what kind of symmetries we have for our Dirac theory and what are the conserved currents that Noether's theorem gives us. So the first symmetry, the only one that I'll have time to cover today, is the global U1 symmetry. So if I take the Dirac spinners and transform them by a constant phase factor, then psi bar of x goes to e to the power minus I alpha of psi bar of x, then this is an obvious symmetry of the Lagrangian for alpha's constant, right? They are not functions of space-time. Okay. Right. So then delta of psi in that case is I alpha of psi, and delta of psi bar is minus I alpha of psi bar. And you plug these, and delta of L is zero. It does not change. At each order, then you can easily show that the conserved current is psi bar of gamma mu of psi. And to show that this is conserved, you have to use the equation of motion. So this is a conserved current for the on-shell Dirac field. Okay. And I'm not going to do that. But this is the famous Dirac current. Dirac was looking for this guy. He wanted to have this thing a probabilistic interpretation. It turned out it doesn't have a probabilistic interpretation. Only in the low energy limit does it have a probabilistic interpretation when you don't have any antiparticles. But what it does is that it has the interpretation of electric current. So you saw an analog of this guy in Dan's class when Dan talked about the complex scalar field, okay? But in that case, if you look at the J0 part, it is, positive definite, right? And Dirac thought, yes, I've got probability density, which is positive. Turns out it's particle density, really. It's charge density. Because although, classically this is on a negative, so its value will depend on what state you apply to. Yeah. So anyway, those are historical remarks, so I don't take them too seriously. So I actually do have a few more minutes because I started a bit late. But I just don't want, this is Friday and people want to go home, I'm sure. So I will let you guys go. Okay? Have a good weekend.